is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Evan Ellis, the Latin American Research Professor at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, immediately to take me in a time machine to the year 2000. The event is tragic, but at the same time revelatory of where Latin America, where South America is today. The event took place in May of 2000, the kidnapping of a journalist. At this instance, it's important to say that this journalist is well and functioning today in a fashion to recover these last 21 years of justice and abuse by authorities or others in Colombia. The name of the journalist, Janeth Bedoya, and she was abducted outside a military prison. She was seeking to interview, as a journalist, a paramilitary leader. She was abused badly, not murdered, and for 21 years she has been seeking justice for what the Colombia government at that time vouchsafed. Evan, this story is new to me. It's in The Guardian. So what I ask you to help me understand is, what was Colombia then in May of 2000? It's completely, profoundly different from my experience of Colombia this last year, talking to a member of the Senate, Senator Cabal, who is now running for the presidency of the country. What was Colombia that we witnessed such a horror as Ms. Bedoya is now seeking to find answers?
John, good morning. As always, it's a pleasure to be on your program. As you point out, Colombia has undergone a remarkable transformation, although there are some elements of continuity with respect to discontent and questions within Colombian society about sources of injustice on both the left and the right. But 2000, that was pretty close to the apex of the FARC revolutionary movement. They were presenting credible military challenges to the state. The state was very weak in its presence across a range of municipalities, especially outside of the major cities such as Bogota, in Medellin, and in Cali, and in Cartagena. At that time, relatively large militias had been formed by the landowners and narcos to protect themselves against the FARC. And so you had a very complex struggle in the countryside. You had human rights abuses on all sides. You had questions of the loyalties and collaboration between the Colombian armed forces and the militias. But More than anything else, there was a sense at that time that even the United States had done an evaluation that within a couple of years, the Colombian state, if nothing was done, could fall. And that understanding of the gravity of the threat was what led then President Pastrana and later, of course, famously President Álvaro Uribe to really turn around the Colombian state, reorganize the Colombian military and expand it in fundamental ways, using cooperation with the United States Plan Colombia, but also through levying significant new taxes on the wealthy and others in Colombia. A number of different things happened, but really the key cycle that the Colombians brought about was the reestablishment of government control in the countryside, little by little. The military basically cut off and eventually largely the defeat of the majority of the FARC, which of course paved the way for the 2016 peace accords. But in many ways, for us here in the United States and the many people, in the U.S. military that's, Colombia, we often use as a success story. Not only the way in which, partly United States aid can, help in the transformation of a country, but on the other side, the way in which the Colombians themselves, by stepping up the plate and reforming their security forces sincerely and putting up the money to do it, and really integrating the military component with the developmental component, were able to turn things around, to the point where today Colombia has become one of our key partners in the region, exporting security, working with us in places like the Northern Triangle states and in Central America against challenges there. So it really has been a profound transformation. And yet I think it bears note to mention that some of the questions about injustice within the Colombian society, persistent corruption, narco trafficking and things, continue to plague Colombia to this day. And the past is a reminder of what could be again in Colombia, if some of these worrisome trends continue.
Yes, Colombia, much in the news. It's undergoing a presidential election now, preparation for a presidential election next spring. At the same time, my understanding is Colombia is under constant attack, asymmetrical warfare, on its border with Venezuela. Venezuela, a failed state led by a dictator, Maduro, and his kindred of Cain that include world capitals of adversaries of the United States and our allies. That would be Tehran, Moscow, Beijing. The list is long. The list also includes Havana. Managua cannot be ruled out. Other capitals. But I come to what appears to be positive information. This is CNN reporting. An alleged financier to embattled Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has been extradited from Cape Verde to the U.S. and is scheduled to appear in court Monday. The U.S. Department of Justice said Sunday. Colombian businessman Alex Saab is expected to make his initial court appearance at the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida. Evan, I'll stop there because the news reporting points to this as a significant success for the United States, for justice, and for the people of Colombia and Venezuela. Alex Saab is a Colombian-born businessman. My understanding is that he's been critical for arms, for cash, for the interlocution between Caracas and Tehran. Does that mean that we're going to learn things in this extradition? Is he going to provide information? What is the expectation about his detention?
Well, John, we certainly hope, and I'm sure the Justice Department certainly hopes that the information that Saab has will be key not only to understanding where Nicolas Maduro and his cronies have diverted literally hundreds of billions of dollars of the Venezuelan people's money, but also understanding the structure of some of the networks of corruption that goes even far beyond Venezuela. And it's interesting because I think the degree to which the extradition of Saab hit a sensitive point is apparent in the severity of the reaction, the shrillness of the reaction that you've seen with Maduro canceling the, peace negotiations in Mexico City with the Venezuelan de jure government of Juan Guaido, with the putting back into prison of the Citgo Six, the Citgo executives that essentially the Venezuelan state had kidnapped on trumped up charges, as well as a number of other activities. And indeed, it was a testimony that they were so desperate to avoid the extradition of Saab that they even had tried to name him a member of the delegation for negotiations in Mexico City, although that didn't work. But the underlying issue here, far beyond this, is the degree to which essentially a group has hijacked the institutions of the Venezuelan state, and as we've talked about on this program before, has used it for a range of different criminal activities, not only the diversion of the oil money, but use of the Bolivarian National Guard to extort the money that's coming in from remittances and other things at the border, taxing and helping to run some of the narco-trafficking operations coming out of Colombia and through Venezuela, taxing and taking of money from illegal gold operations, including bringing Colombia's own ELN guerrillas into the Orinoco mining region to help them, better organize these illegal gold mining. So really what we have here is a criminal state at a level that's unprecedented, certainly in the region's history. And so the question is, certainly William Saab is not the only person, but he's considered one of the key figures as an interlocutor in a number of these schemes. So the technical piece is that he's specifically accused of laundering about $350 million from a low-income housing project. In addition to previously, he was seen as playing a key role in profiteering off of the giving out of food boxes, the famous clap boxes to the Venezuelan people, among other things. But the belief is this is really the only the tip of the icebox, that he was essentially, in some ways, one of the bag men that knew where all of the diverted Venezuelan money was going. And so certainly the worry for them and the hope for us is that getting some of that information to begin to figure out where the money has gone and to unravel this. But certainly it's a warning call for Maduro, that if there is ever any doubt before that the Justice Department had specific indictable information on the range of the leadership, including Maduro himself and his associates, this really, makes that much more clear that if they ever lose power, they are going to face the loss of their liberty.
I understand that Maduro has many sources of cash and information and bad actors. Is Saab considered a mastermind, or was he an opportunity for the U.S. to intervene? I understand his plane landed originally at Cape Verde Island for refueling either to or from Tehran. I don't recall the details. But was this something that had been put together over a long period of time? In other words, is he Mr. Big, or is he a lieutenant?
My understanding, he's a lieutenant. This is, not unlike, how we've taken down mafia operations in the past. He's certainly not the biggest fish, but the degree to which he runs with others such as Tariq Al-Assami, who organizes probably an even larger chunk of some of those relationships. Clearly the relationship to illicit Iran money is there, given that he was headed, to Iran. There are a series of other things he's been involved with. But this really is a triumph for, U.S. Justice Department and in our interagency efforts. Because in order to get this, at least as I understand it, essentially he wasn't planning to land in Cape Verde. His attempt to land in two neighboring African states were blocked, probably due to U.S. diplomatic pressure, which forced him to land in Cape Verde. And then having landed in Cape Verde, there was, again, a 16-month long, legal struggle up to the point where cooperating with us, they finally let us have them. So in terms of interagency coordination and the role of our, what's possible through diplomatic efforts and good, DOJ work on the ground. So again, it was a long, difficult fight. I'm sure it was technically congratulating themselves. But the hope is that all those efforts will lead to some good information that could help to unravel the money trail with some of the even bigger fish in Venezuela.
Professor Evan Ellis, Latin American research professor for the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. We're going to turn to a change of command at Southcom and what this means going forward for the threat. We've just identified some of it from Latin America. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.